only in this city would it be necessary for a rabbi to say as he passes the year in review that the most important event of last year was not the victories of the football team, which allowed them to play in this kind of bitter cold. But in the sense that hard work and the rather pointless results suggest something about the nature of last year. It was a year of hard work, frenetic activity, great frustration, and not much success. Throughout the year, I found myself thinking of the book of Ecclesiastes, from which I read this morning. From the question which ends that simple little poem, which suggests to us that there's a certain futility to life, that things really do not move ahead, progress. There's a time to build, and there's a time to tear down, there's a time to sow, there's a time to rend, there's a time to be born, there's a time to die. That final line, Ma yitron l'adam l'chol amalo. To what profit, then, is all man's work? What's the long-range benefit to all of our effort? And the more I turn the mood of Ecclesiastes over in my mind, it's a book written by someone who was worldly and much experienced and worldly wise and worldly weary. I felt that it captures so much of the mood of our times. Somewhere in the book, I came across the phrase, wisdom is better than strength, but one sinner destroys much good. And I thought of the paranoid with a gun who has been shooting black children in Atlanta. I thought of all those years of determined and patient effort by tens of thousands of Americans to overcome racial prejudice, and the way one paranoid with one gun can poison a city and disturb the relations between the races of a nation. And I thought of the events in San Salvador, the poor little Latin American country, which has known centuries of oligarchy and misrule, where finally, a year and a half ago, the oligarchy was overthrown and a moderate government elected by democratic procedures. The moderation can mean inaction or it can mean slow and deliberate progress. This government has nationalized the banks, and this government has broken up the largest of the big land monopolies. But there are in San Salvador, throughout Latin America, throughout the Third World, ideologues of the left and the right, men armed with guns, self-willed men, unelected, responsive to nothing but to their own sense of duty and self-interest, who are determined to have their way and who are making it impossible for such a government to govern. And the question is simply, will it be the right or the left which will force the peasantry, the poor of San Salvador and Guatemala and the other countries of the area to serve them and their interests? We're a world which has much wisdom. We know what should be done in many cases. But a small group of terrorists, or a single man with a gun, or a fanatic group of ideologues can unseat reason and do great harm. It's a world where we live in a time which is full of passion and of ideology and of anger and of violence. And so despite our vast libraries and our giant computers, despite all that we know and can spin out of our own minds as to the way in which society ought to go, the economy ought to be directed, politics ought to be managed, we seem somehow trapped. Trapped by passion, trapped by the eccentricities of human emotions and feelings, trapped by the power of a small group among us to unseat reason, to sin, and to have their own way. What profit then to man from all of his labors? When I wished one of you this year a happy new year, you said, you answered me, let it only be no worse than the last. Unfortunately, that sense of reduced expectations, that sense that we're running in place, or perhaps running in place and losing place, earning more money but having less buying power, that sense that the world is somehow running out from underneath us, it's part of the mood of our times. 1980 was a time when no one seemed to be able to achieve anything, any end successfully. It began with the hostages in Iran. It ended with the hostages in Iran. Now, there were 7 less Americans in Iran at the end of the year than at the beginning of the year. 6 had not been caught by the Iranian so-called students. They'd hidden out in the Canadian embassy. You recall the Canadian ambassador smuggled them out with his own staff. And one came down with a mysterious disease which troubled the Iranians, and they released him to the West. But the 52 remain. And whatever American policy was, and was often difficult to describe exactly what it was not successful in freeing these 52. By the beginning of last year, we had made clear to the world that we were willing to, in effect, pay ransom for the release of the 52. We should, in fact, have been claiming indemnity, but we were willing to pay ransom. We were willing to negotiate. We were talking about being patient, but it was to no avail. And when patience seemed to run out and we attempted a commando attack to release the captives, it was bungled. And we went back to bargaining. We found again that there was no way to achieve our objectives. Much effort, much energy, much frustration, little to show for it. 1980 was a year in which the boat people were again in the news. During 1979, the boat people had been from East Asia. And during 1980, we brought into this country about 180,000 East Asian refugees as our part of a world relief attempt to free the Cambodians and the South Vietnamese from poverty, from the displaced person camps of that part of the world. But last year, the problem was the West Indian boat people. 110,000 Cubans who got onto the small crafts in Cuba and crossed the 90 miles of water to South Florida. And the 10,000 Haitians who crossed a slightly larger distance to come to South Florida. And the 500,000 Mexicans who walked across the Rio Grande to come to the American Southwest. It was clear during 1980 that we had no seriously conceived immigration policy. And on the matter of the boat people, the president was conflicted. On the one hand, he had those humane instincts which said that America ought to be the land of the Statue of Liberty, which is a land which welcomes those who flee from persecution. But on the other hand, he had no way that he could devise to separate those who came as legitimate refugees from the agents provocateurs and the prisoners that Mr. Castro was happily dumping on the United States. He dithered in Washington and South Florida suffered. There were no plans really to successfully take in this avalanche of refugees, to disperse them, to provide occupation, training, housing, shelter, all the things that any immigrant needs. Hundreds of them ended in our prisons. We didn't know what to do with them. It was a sad spectacle, a spectacle which redounded to no one's credit. But to Americans, it was a symbol in many ways of an administration which was very active, very full of plans, but seemed unable to bring any plan of any kind to fruition. And so in November, when Americans went to the polls, at least one in two of us went to the polls, we voted out of office a man who basic decency we tended not to suspect, but whose good judgment we tended to suspect. A man who did not seem to be able to separate the forest from the trees. And we elected a man who spoke to us simply and directly. There was a great desire for simple answers to the complex problems. We were tired of being frustrated, not knowing where we were going, moving zigs and zagging in international affairs and foreign policy and the like. A man was voted out more than another man being voted in. And most Americans faced the new year, January 20th, simply praying that Mr. Reagan will have wisdom to go with his simplicity and that he will have judgment to glow with the very forceful expression of the national will which he was able to utter. And my favorite New Year's phrase, I don't remember where I read it, was the one that said, ring out the old, ring in the older. For we had elected as President of the United States the oldest man ever to be elected to that office in the history of the nation. But the United States was not the only country caught up in energy, activity, frustration, and lack of success. It was only the year before the last New Year's that the Russians invaded Afghanistan and found themselves mired in their own Vietnam. We don't know the cost to the Russians in manpower or equipment of this year-long counterinsurgency effort. But we do know that as it was with American troops in the 1960s in Vietnam, the Russians occupy the cities and the roads, and the insurgents occupy the countryside and the hills, and they do not see the major equipment and the high technology of the Soviet troops do not seem able to destroy the pockets of insurgent resistance to the takeover of that mountainous country. Our reaction was much of the same. The president said that we would not ship to the Soviet 16 million metric tons of grain which had been ordered. But the Argentinians would not go along, and they picked up the delivery schedule, and later in the year, because America had not been able to make good the embargo, Australia and Canada agreed to make up the rest of the fall of the Soviet grain purchase needs. And we announced that we would embargo the sale of high-technology computers and drilling equipment to the Soviet Union. But because we had announced the embargo without consulting our allies, and because our allies are what our allies are, the French and the West Germans quickly agreed to sell high-technology computers and drilling equipment to the Soviet Union. And so we were reduced to saying that we would boycott the Moscow Olympics, and boycott it we did. And the Moscow Olympics went on in any case, to the delectation of some few thousand spectators and tens of thousands of Russian security police. Mr. Brezhnev probably gained some consolation by the fact that the Olympics were able to go on. But he could gain no sense of accomplishment from what was happening in Eastern Europe, particularly in Poland, where he faced his inability to take effective action. In Poland, as you know, the workers struck, particularly in the northern seaports. The Polish economy is in shambles. There's been a lack of food, basic staples, there's been inflation, a lack of consumer items. And that ultimate anomaly occurred in that a communist nation, presumably, whose government is presumably devoted to the well-being of the laboring classes, found itself suddenly confronted by the laboring classes, demanding the right to organize themselves into a movement called Solidarity, a labor union, an independent labor union, organized because they could not trust the Communist Party government. Now, ideologues cannot tolerate this kind of challenge to Marxian dialectics. And the Soviets closed the East German border, and they marched their troops and countermarched them in Eastern Europe and in Russia. But for many reasons, Mr. Brezhnev found it impossible, or has found it as yet impossible, to cross the border, to take the situation in hand, to do what he must want to do, and that is to break the Solidarity movement and reduce the laboring classes again to subservience to the Communist Party. Largely, I suspect, because he does not know what he would be, how he would be able to survive the conquest, how many tens of thousands of Russian troops would be on police duty for years to keep the Polish population in line. So Mr. Carter had his frustrations, Mr. Brezhnev had his frustrations, and throughout our world there was inflation and unemployment. National economies were growing at a much reduced rate from the 50s and from the 60s and early 70s. And even in that one part of the world which should be enjoying all the good things of life, the OPEC world, things were not going the way that they should be. There was little success. $100 billion of wealth was transferred from the free world and from the third world to the OPEC world last year. That world should be enjoying a renaissance, security, wealth, all the good things. The groundwork should be there for the massive development of these nations, as nations which enjoy an advanced technology and industry and commerce of all kinds. But what do we see? We saw on the one hand the wealthiest of these nations, Saudi Arabia, fearing for its life, spending much of the wealth that was coming into it to hire mercenaries from Pakistan to keep the oil workers in line, pleading with the United States for various kinds of advanced military equipment to guarantee its borders. We saw Iraq and Iran fall into a war in which each was seemingly enjoying grinding the other's oil lines and oil refineries into the dust from which they had originally sprouted. We saw Syria and Jordan fighting a battle of words which threatened during the latter part of the year to become an active war. We saw Libya and Algeria fall out over the control of the Polisario, the insurgency movement in southern Morocco. We saw the Libyans begin to move against Black Africa and conquering the northern part of Chad. We saw insurgency in Iran itself, the Kurds, the Arabs, moving against the Shiites. We saw insurgency in Iran, the Kurds and the Shiites moving against the Alawi. We saw North Yemen and South Yemen again heating up their border war. Frustration, tension, violence, war, instability. And so the great wealth which is being transferred from the free world, our monies, and the little wealth that is being transferred from the impoverished world and is preventing that world from having any opportunity to emerge from its backwardness is being wasted, and rivalries and competition of all kinds being salted away in Swiss banks and gold bars. instead of even that part of the world enjoying the Renaissance which great wealth should bring to it. 1980 was a time for it of tension, of danger, and of war. And when we look from international affairs to domestic affairs, we found little in our country or in any country to take great stock of pride in. It's not a year in which America moved in a major way towards a solution of any of our domestic problems. More importantly, it was a year in which we recognized that most of our problems did not permit of the kind of utopian solutions which we had once envisaged. Take the question of immigration, which I've already raised. We want to help the world. What limits does our nation have? Can we continue as we did throughout the 1970s to take in perhaps 10 million people, 10 million semi-skilled, many illiterate peoples? Well, 8% of our population in the workforce is out of work. Now, obviously, it need not be an either-or situation, open doors or closed doors. But clearly the kind of situation that we were faced with from Cuba and Haiti, when people were simply dumped on our shores, and we simply took them in without thought to the social cost, the economic cost, to the employment cost involved, without thought to their own purposes in coming. For say, some came here to act in the refugee communities as agents of a foreign government, clearly. All of this showed that there needs to be a forthright, hopefully humane immigration policy, which will take into consideration all of the complex needs of the society. We've talked a great deal in the last decade about an economy of limits. We're beginning to realize what this means, that we can't have all the guns we want and all the butter that we want. We can't take in all the immigrants we'd like to and have full employment. We can't provide all the welfare and government services we'd like to provide and have lower taxes. You can't have everything that you want in an economy of limits. And this new administration was clearly facing some very hard decisions as to where priorities would be placed and what these priorities would be. In the months and the years ahead, it's going to be for all of us a question not of more, but of less. Mr. Reagan was elected on a platform which promised a reduction in our taxes, but every one of us knows that as of the first of the year, our Social Security taxes have already been decreed that they shall go up. And we know that Ohio had a $500 million budget deficit, and our taxes will be going up. We know that the city of Cleveland has an $8 million deficit and $50 million in debts, and that those taxes must go up. And we know that if Mr. Reagan is to make good on his pledge to increase defense spending, and it is true, as a RAND study showed during last year, that the Soviets spent $100 billion more than the United States during 1970 on armaments, it is true that we're going to spend more on arms, and there's going to be less to be spent in social welfare programs and other areas of the economy. And if we spend less money on those areas of the economy, there will be many who will be hurt, those least able to survive, least able to make their voices heard, and the amount of frustration in society will rise, and the tension between classes and between races will increase, and there'll be a spillover into the increase of crime, and there'll be a social cost to pay which will not be seen on our tax forms, but will be seen in the amenity and the gentleness and the decency of our lives. We face a future not of more, but of less. Now, there were those who looked on last year and saw the problems as I've tried to lay them out, and who analyzed the problems, I suspect, as I would analyze them, that basically the economic problems which face the nation and almost everything that flows domestically flows from a lack of booming prosperity, All this throughout the world is to be laid at the feet of two major causes. The high cost of energy, the deficit in our national economy in terms of international trade caused by energy, and by the population explosion and the parallel explosion of expectations. You can't take $100 billion out of the economies of the Western world and expect prosperity. The growth of the national product of the various countries of Europe and of the Western Hemisphere have diminished. Less jobs are being created. It's very increasingly difficult for companies to compete. There's less money to invest in capital and new industry. A slowdown, snowball slowdown in the economy. And beyond that, the world seems unable, incapable, unwilling to bring the population explosion to an end. We finally had our decennial census. Whether the figures be correct or not, the country has grown by some 20 or 25% in a decade. And that growth has been largely in those areas of the society which have the least money, least ability to provide for their young. And there are probably another 10 million or more illegal immigrants in the United States. And the United States is really not an overpopulated country by any means. The world is. But we have still the great empty spaces. And if you look across our world in the last century, you find not a 20% increase in population, but a 40 to 45% increase in the world's population. And you find that we have twice as many illiterates in the world in 1980 as we had in 1970. And you find major churches of the world still opposed theologically because of medieval theological doctrine to programs of birth control. You find the world unwilling to face up to the sheer fact of numbers. Numbers require space. Numbers require food. Numbers require shelter. You have to provide for them jobs and opportunity. These jobs, opportunity, the food is not infinitely expandable. But it's not only a matter of numbers. It's a matter of want, of expectation. Once upon a time, the world consisted of a small elite, an urban proletariat and a peasantry, largely peasantry, who had very few wants and expectations. The children expected to live in the misery that their parents lived. But now there's a transistor. Now there's a television, now there are movies, now there are mass communications, and everyone wants what anybody else has. And everybody can't have what everybody else has. Though it may be just to say everybody should have the same, you can't simply take up wealth and chop it up in equal portions and say, here is yours. Wealth must be produced. And though it's clear that the United States and the other prosperous nations of the Western world will have proportionally less in the years ahead, there's no easy way to divert this money elsewhere. And when it is diverted, as in the case of OPEC, it doesn't necessarily add up to the sum total of happiness for tens of millions of people. The OPEC countries are the most underpopulated countries on the face of the earth, the countries that need it the least. And the countries who seem to be able to handle it hardly at all. More expectations, higher expectations, vaunting expectations, more people, more mouths, more illiterates, less with which to cope with massive social problems. That's the reality, the cold winter reality of the 1980s. Now, it's not a hopeless reality by any means. We have wisdom. We know some of the things that can be done. There are programs, economic, social, educational, otherwise, which can be put in place. Wise men and women, when the going gets tough, roll up their sleeves and get going. The book of Ecclesiastes tells us that sweet is the sleep of the toiler whether he has much or he has little. In the 1980s, more will be demanded of us in terms of energy, in terms of citizenship, in terms of commitment. In many ways, that's to our good, because many of us have gotten awfully unhappy living lives turned in on themselves. There's plenty of work out there, and there's a great deal of satisfaction that can come to us as we face and work as best we can to solve the problems of the world. But the problems will not be solved in any utopian way. And the great, great problem which faces our world, and I don't know whether it can be resolved, is the gap between expectations and possibilities. We cannot provide enough for everyone. It's a fact of life. We cannot do everything that needs to be done to bring equal justice into this, the largest and most prosperous country on the face of the earth, much less across the globe. Will people be satisfied with reasonable progress, with a reasonable resolution of their needs? Are expectations so fueled, passions so high, anger so deep, that nothing short of bringing the whole house, the whole temple down on us, as Samson once brought down the temple upon the Philistines, satisfy anyone? San Salvador suggests that the solution may be the sense of form of national suicide. That's not the only possible scenario. But it means, if we're going to walk any other way, that we must walk with reason and with strength and with conviction, with determination, not give in to passion or superstition. One of the things that worried me most was a strange little, this past week or so, was a strange little phenomenon that I began to read in the public press, all manners of pontification by those who look into crystal balls, and those who write horoscopes, and the Gene Dixons of our world about the future. Somehow Mount St. Helens and the earthquakes in Algeria and the earthquakes in southern Italy were held to be evil portents of the times. How credulous have we become? How much have we given over reason to a desire to feel that somehow nature is conspiring against us? No one is conspiring against us. We are. We, the human race, are conspiring against the human race. Judaism rests upon a very simple proposition. The meteors mean nothing. The way the planets pass each other in their cycles means nothing. There is no such thing as a destiny written in the stars. If you are willing and obedient, God says, you shall eat of the good of the earth. And if you're selfish and self-centered and committed to goals which are illegitimate, you shall be destroyed from off the face of the earth. The future is in our hands. Ecclesiastes was dyspeptic. He's an old man, world weary. Yet he too recognized that life goes on and life is not fated. The end of the matter, all having been said, fear the Lord and obey his commandments, for that is the whole of it. Fear God, have faith, do the right, and we'll muddle through. We will, provided we lower our expectations, and provided we recognize the tremendous demands that are going to be made on us in the years that lie ahead. I'm glad that this New Year's I don't have to say to you, L'shana tova, may it be only a good year. It should be a good year for all of us, but it's up to us to make it so. Amen.